Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about political conflict that has been going on now really since late December in Kenya. In late December, voters there went to the polls to elect a president. The incumbent, Mwai Kibaki, claimed victory. But the leader of the opposition, a man named Raila Odinga, accused the government of fraud. Almost 1,500 people were killed in the violence that followed. Now there has been an agreement. A coalition government has been formed. However, there are some people that wonder whether the two men, Mwai Kibaki and Raila Odinga, can actually work together. We'll be talking this morning about the Kenyan political crisis with David Zaremka. He is coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative of the Friends Peace Teams. Well, this is a program that was created by the Friends Peace Teams. That's an organization of 16 Quaker yearly meetings in the United States who have come together to support the traditional emphasis that Quakers have on promoting peace in the world. Back in April of 1998, these folks realized that Quakers who live in the Great Lakes region of Africa, and they make up something like half, almost half of the Quakers in the world, these people were living in countries that experienced a great deal of violence and social unrest and civil war and genocide. So in 1999, a delegation went. They visited Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi, and as a result, the Friends Peace Teams decided to create the African Great Lakes Initiative to support peacemaking activities there at the grassroots level. So that's what it is all about, and we'll be talking this morning about Kenya, and as we do, questions certainly from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you live here in Champaign-Urbana, use that first number, 333-9455. And if you're hearing us over the air around Illinois or Indiana, or you're listening on the Internet, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Zaremka, hello.
Hello, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Well, thanks for talking with us once again. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the history of your involvement in Kenya.
Well, I was in the Peace Corps in Kenya back in the 1960s. And prior to that, actually, I taught Rwandan refugees in IDP camps in Tanzania. So I've been involved in this part of Africa for an awful long time.
Mm-hmm. And you were in Kenya during this time that we're talking about?
Oh, yes, I was. Mm-hmm. I was an election observer for the elections on the 27th of December.
Okay. Well, maybe we might start there. And as I said in the very brief introduction, after almost as soon as the elections had taken place and the current president, Mr. Kibaki, said that he had won, the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, said that there had been fraud. And in fact, he said straight out that he thought that the government had stolen the election. What can you say about how this election was conducted?
Well, the voting itself was conducted extremely well. At the polling place I was, which was upcountry in a rural area, people came early. They stayed in line for an hour or two in the morning. In the afternoon, it was a little quicker. They cast their votes. I observed the counting of the votes at this polling station, and every ballot that anybody had any question on, they were allowed to look at it, and there really were no complaints. And then all the observers of the various political parties signed off on the vote in that particular polling place. So that part of the election was done extremely well. It was when those votes were taken to Nairobi and tabulated, tallied, that the allegations of corruption came in and changing the vote tallies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you believe happened here?
Well, I think the Kibaki government pretty much planned to win the election one way or the other. And almost all the election observers from the EU, European Union, the African Union, the Commonwealth, were not allowed in the tallying room at critical times, and none of them have said that this election was tallied properly. And including this is the head of the Electoral Commission who who later said he wasn't sure who actually won the election.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is it. I do recall having read that very thought, that, and also recall that polls that were conducted before the voting took place showed that support for the two men, Mwai Kibaki and Raila Odinga, was running very close. And for that reason, and because of what happened with the way that the votes were handled, that I think a lot of people felt afterwards that there was really no way to establish who did in fact win the election. Do you think that was the case?
Well, right after the election, people were saying, "Let's have a recount, retelling of the votes." But already by that time, too many of them had been tampered with, that nobody was going to have credence if one side won or the other side won. They would both cry foul over the tallying. So that did not become an option, and that was later dropped as a demand by anybody.
Mm-hmm. The coverage of the violence that followed really tended to play up the ethnic divisions between the supporters of between the two men and their supporters, and we get the kind of analysis that so often in so many places that we get when there is conflict like this, and that is that, well, we have long-standing ethnic divisions within the country, and that the people have essentially been fighting with one another for a long time, and that what we see now is simply a manifestation of that same thing, that same ethnic rivalry. And you have long kind of experience in Kenya, so you would have had the opportunity to see how people from various groups did indeed get along with one another. Did ethnicity or ethnic rivalry play some kind of role in the violence that followed the election?
Well, that's the spin that almost all the international coverage of the events are based on. But that's really a very superficial understanding, as if we would say that World War I and World War II could be explained very nicely by the old ethnic hatreds between the Germans on the one hand and the French and the English and the Russians on the other hand. As you see, this doesn't really explain anything. And Raila Odinga himself says that, you know, this is not an ethnic conflict because many Kikuyu voted for him, and he puts up the example that 3,000 people in Kibaki's home constituency voted for him. And then, of course, another interesting point is that one of his daughter-in-laws is a Kikuyu from the other ethnic group. And there's a lot of ethnic mixing, ethnic marriages, interethnic marriages, and to play this as that kind of a thing is superficial, as I said. In fact, whenever change has occurred in Kenya, it's when the Luo and the Kikuyu have combined together. This first happened during the independence in 1963, and then again happened in 2002 when the Luo and Kikuyu united against Moi, who was then the president.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is it not the case, though, that since Kenya's independence, the men who have been president, Jomo Kenyatta and Daniel Moi, were in fact Kikuyu, as is Mwai Kibaki. Is there or has there been any kind of resentment of people from other ethnic groups toward the Kikuyu for their dominance of government?
Well, Moi was not a Kikuyu. He was a Kalenjin from the Rift Valley, who was vice president at the time when Kenyatta died, and he quickly made a peace with the Kikuyu sort of establishment and then ruled as pretty much as a dictator for the next 24 years until he was finally ousted in 2002. So there has been other people than just Kikuyu running the being in president.
Well, is this though? Does it have to do with the resentment over how resources are allocated and over who has power, who benefits?
Well, at the time that the British gave independence to Kenya, they gave independence to their loyalist Kikuyu supporters, which was Kenyatta and Kibaki. Kibaki was Minister of Finance in the Kenyatta government. And so a small group of powerful, mostly Kikuyu elite came to control much of the resources of the country, and it's this control that many of the other people who are left out have been complaining against. And a good part of the violence had to do with this disparity between this extremely wealthy class and the common people who are quite known, not well off at all.
Yeah, so it does really it defies this easy explanation of breaking down along lines of ethnicity, and what it's more about is access to power, and also who benefits from that access to power.
That's correct.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about the idea that this is in many ways a kind of a class conflict, and it's a have versus have not kind of a conflict?
Well, Kenya is supposed to be one of the most unequal countries in the world, and Kenya is not really as poor as some of the other countries like Burundi or Rwanda, and so there are a lot of resources in the country, and the elite who have controlled the government and have also been rather corrupt over the years, so that they've stolen a good amount of money, and this allowed them to buy up companies and land and other resources in the country, and essentially have controlled the country to their liking since the time of independence. So it's the average young person in particular who doesn't have much stake in the society, doesn't see much hope for the future, who were the ones that did most of the rioting and looting during the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with David Zaremka. He is coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative of the Friends Peace Teams. This is an effort by the Quakers to reach out to Quakers living in the Great Lakes region of Africa. And we're talking about Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, a place where they recognized there was a good deal of suffering, violence, and wanted to be involved in that, as Quakers are, promoting peace. And so this is something that was organized in the beginning of 1999. Our guest has long experience in Kenya. He worked there in the Peace Corps, has lived there, and was involved in the elections of the 27th of December as an observer. And we thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation with him to talk a little bit about his experiences there in Kenya. And of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think that one of the things that seemed to be noted in at least all of the coverage that I read of the violence that followed the elections was people saying that they were very surprised that this had happened in Kenya, because it was a place that seemed to be one of the more stable countries in Africa. Do you think that there's some particular reason, obviously, that this was touched off by the results of the election and that anger that people felt toward the current government and toward the current president about what they saw as a clear case of electoral fraud? So that was the precipitating event. But has there been anything else going on that would answer this question? Well, why did this happen now after what seemed to be a period of political stability in Kenya?
Well, I never believed that. That's the conventional wisdom, but I never believed it. I was there on July 5th, 1969, when the Luo minister, Tom Mboya, was assassinated in Nairobi, and the country began to disintegrate pretty much like it did after the election here. And there's been a number of other political assassinations, and the election itself was quite violent, with impunity for anybody who was using violence in the election. And it was because I felt that the Kenyan society was inherently unstable that we brought our program called Alternatives to Violence, which teaches people nonviolent conflict resolution, to Kenya in 2003, because I felt that the country really did need that kind of change.
Mm-hmm. What do you think now? There has been an agreement reached between the two men and their supporters. So we are going to have a coalition government. Mr. Kibaki will continue to be the president, and a new position of prime minister is going to be created and will be taken up by Mr. Odinga. And so we now see the two men essentially sitting side by side and shaking hands and saying that they're going to move forward and try to put this behind them. What do you think are the real possibilities that the two of them and the people that support them will be able to work with, all be able to work together?
Well, I think it's a little too soon to say definitively which is if they are going to be able to work together. But I think the indication so far is that they're doing decently well. But the problem is the politicians can get along real well with each other, and they can just divide up the pie in a different way than it was before. And then the real questions are, is the distribution of wealth going to be addressed? Is the land issues going to be addressed? Are the alienation of the youth going to be addressed? Is the over-centralization of the government going to be addressed? There are many, many issues that have to be dealt with. And when Kofi Annan was there negotiating with the two sides to agreement, he clearly indicated that a political settlement was just like a first step and that all these other things needed to be addressed. And if they are, I think Kenya can recover and go ahead quite quickly. But if they're not, then I think in the next few years there'll be another round of violence. And as we've seen in other countries in the region, each cycle becomes more violent than the previous one.
Yeah, it certainly does seem that part of the problem is here that the people here who hold the reins of power, it's a small group. And essentially it has been in many ways the same kind of people all along since the country became independent. I think even Mr. Odinga, his father, was also an important figure in the post-colonial politics of Kenya.
That's correct. I mean, he was vice president for a while. So, yes, I think Odinga is part of the same class. Now, the real question is, FDR during the Depression here, is there some leader who's going to put the country back together again, or is it just going to continue to disintegrate?
Mm-hmm. Well, what have they said anything about what it is they're going to be doing now to move forward and particularly to address the needs of people in Kenya?
Oh, yes. Part of the agreement was a whole bunch of things. There's first going to be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's going to deal with all the issues and conflicts that have occurred perhaps since independence and maybe perhaps since the British showed up. There's different slants on that one. There's going to be another commission on investigating the this election itself, what went wrong, why it went wrong, and give recommendations of how it can be corrected in the future. And then the third one is there are going to be investigations into violence. Human Rights Watch has just put out a report that a number of the politicians on both sides may have been instigators in the violence, particularly in the Rift Valley. So there's going to be another commission to deal with the violence, and all of these are going to be broadcast live on TV.
Hmm. Given the fact that now particularly the two men, Mr. Kibaki, Mr. Odinga, have had this agreement and they're going to try to move forward in this coalition government, I wonder, do you think that it's likely that the commission that's looking into the election and how it was conducted would actually come out now at this point or whenever would actually come out with a finding that there was indeed widespread fraud and that somehow Mr. Kibaki or his supporters were implicated in this?
Well, I think that that's very likely that they will. I think that their goal is much more to look and see what went wrong with this election and to correct whatever those mistakes were so that this doesn't happen again and so that people in the country can be confident that the votes are being counted properly.
What other kind of divisions exist? I mean, you talked about the fact that there are certainly class divisions here in the country that don't necessarily line up with ethnic divisions. What other kind of divisions? Are there, for example, divisions between urban and rural? There are divisions between younger people and older people?
Well, I think the one between younger and older people is very important. Many older people voted for Kibaki because he's been around for a long time. The young people felt disenfranchised and felt that Odinga was going to bring change to the country, and so they've voted for him. I was in a meeting where two people said that they voted for Kibaki and their children voted for Odinga, and there was great tension in the family because of that division between the generations. Hmm. And there's no doubt that the ODM, that's the opposition party, won many more seats in parliament than Kibaki's party did. And many of these new MPs are much younger and much better educated than the former MPs. So the youth got the younger people, and in Kenya, youth is anybody under 35. So those people did get a bigger stake in the government than before, but then they're at the top. They didn't get what they felt they needed.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point to make sure that we mention that the opposition had a significant showing in the elections for parliament, and I think that that was one of the things that Mr. Odinga used to bolster his argument that there was something wrong with the result on the presidential level. His argument was something like, well, do you really think that people would have voted for Kibaki for president but then would have voted for the opposition candidate for the parliament? And I think probably a lot of people would say, well, that would seem to be a little bit unlikely.
Well, it's also that the ODM party won 6 out of the 8 provinces, and most of the major cities were won by ODM, except in the central province, which where Kibaki comes from. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly major sweep by the opposition, except at the presidency level.
How is the power going to be divided up between now the two men? The one man, Mr. Kibaki, is going to continue to be the president, and the opposition leader, Mr. Odinga, he's going to be the prime minister. What sort of and the prime minister? This is a new position. What sort of power comes with that, and how are they going to divide things between them?
Well, I think that they have. There's going to be a lot of negotiations and perhaps conflicts over the details of how this sharing is going to be done. We also have the personalities involved. Kibaki is fairly elderly. He's does not give press conferences very often. In fact, I don't think he ever does, and doesn't speak a whole lot in public and come out in public and do that. While Odinga is sort of the he's the Obama of there. I mean, he's Aluo, just like Obama's father. And he's out there giving talks all the time, speaking to the press, speaking at funerals and all kinds of other instances. And, of course, he's much younger. And so it's quite possible that he will use his, energy and articulateness to actually move the country along much faster than Kibaki is going to be able to, I guess, hold it back, if you want to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. How do people, do Kenyans think of themselves as Kenyans? Is there a sense of national identity, and how is that balanced with whatever kinds of other identities people would have, whether that be with the ethnic group from which they come or maybe the part of Kenya that where they live? How do those two things balance up?
Well, I think most Kenyans, particularly those who have any amount of education and have moved out of their original area, have very much feel like they're Kenyans. But what happens in elections there is that politicians, and we do this in the United States, people latch onto their ethnicity as a method of getting votes, and this is very prevalent in Kenya and can be very detrimental because politics has become quite dependent upon what area of the country you come from.
We are on a midpoint here, and I would like to introduce once again our guest for this hour of Focus, David Zaremka. He is the coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative of the Friends Peace Teams. It's a program that's made up of the peace teams, made up of 16 Quaker yearly meetings in the U.S. who have come together to support what is the traditional emphasis of Quakers, that is promoting peace. It came to their attention that there was a lot of problem in Africa in this particular region, the Great Lakes region of Africa, where almost half of the Quakers in the world live. They were very concerned about the level of violence and social unrest there. They made a visit, and as a result, they decided to create this initiative, the African Great Lakes Initiative, to support grassroots peacemaking efforts. And our guest has lived in Kenya. He has quite a bit of experience there, worked in the Peace Corps there in Kenya, and also was an observer of the election that we here have been talking about here. It took place on December 27th. As we have explained, the current president, his name is Mwai Kibaki, said that he had won. The leader of the opposition, Raila Odinga, said that there had been fraud and that the election had been stolen by the government. There was violence that followed. Almost 1,500 people were killed. There has now been an agreement between the two men and their parties to form a kind of coalition government. Mr. Kibaki will continue to be the president, and Raila Odinga is going to be the prime minister. It remains to be seen just how well they'll be able to work together. We thought it'd be interesting to talk with Mr. Zaremka, get some of his personal experience there on the ground in Kenya. You may, if you listen regularly to the show, you may recall that he was with us not all that long ago to talk. He was here actually in Champaign-Urbana, and he and some other folks were on the program to talk a little bit about the African Great Lakes Initiative. By the way, if you're interested in finding out more about this, they do indeed have a website. So you can, if you have internet access, you can go to www.agliolinne.org, and that way you can find out. Or I suppose if you just put in African Great Lakes Initiative or Friends Peace Teams into your web browsers, you can find it that way too. And of course, questions here are welcome on the program. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There are certainly organizations like yours, non-governmental organizations, and governmental organizations are active in Kenya. Does the involvement of the international community, how does that play into this? And does it help, or are there times that it actually makes things worse?
Well, I think without the international community's involvement in this one, there would never have been a power-sharing agreement. And the interest in Kenya was extraordinary. Archbishop Tutu came for a couple of days. Then John Kafur, who's the president of Ghana and the head of the AU, came for a few days. And then Kofi Annan stayed for a month and led the negotiation team that brought about the resolution. And when things were getting bad, he announced that he's not leaving until there's a power-sharing agreement. And then even Condoleezza Rice came, and many others, and an amazing amount of international pressure was put on Kenya and on the two sides to negotiate some kind of an agreement. And I think this is actually a rather significant involvement of the international community in a constructive way, because, of course, if Kenya had sort of gone down to the tubes in violence and then the UN had to come in with some peacekeepers, there would have been a lot more death, there would have been a lot more destruction, and of course it would have cost multiples of times more than these negotiations that were there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think certainly you have to give Mr. Annan credit for going and for hanging in there, certainly because early on, the kind of reporting that came out about what was going on, his effort to mediate this conflict, it didn't, at least at the beginning, it didn't look very good. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of reason for optimism, as I say, at least at the start.
Well, I think that for a good while, I mean, there were, you know, as it goes, it was ups and downs. You know, one day it looked like something was happening, the next day it would be retracted and you felt like you were going backwards. And this up and down happened many times. But he, like I say, he stuck in there, and when he was on TV or on the radio, he was always very calm and articulate, and people would try to goad him into saying something inopportune, and he would never do that. I mean, he's a great diplomat. I guess 10 years in the United Nations teaches you that. Mm-hmm. But he did a very, very skillful job.
Now, obviously, there is a lot of rebuilding that's going to have to go on, rebuilding of relationships between people and rebuilding of trust in this process of trying to move forward. Is this something that your organization, the Great Lakes Initiative, is involved in? What sort of things are you doing?
Well, our big project right now is that we have this Alternative Dividends AVP program, which teaches nonviolent conflict resolution to people. And we want to do, probably in the next 6 months, we want to do 200 workshops with youth that were involved in the violence or perhaps involved in the violence. And these are three-day-long workshops, and they cover such things as respect for yourself, respect for others, communication skills, cooperation, and then conflict resolution techniques. And with this, we hope that we can turn around the emphasis on sort of spontaneous violence that was destructive to pretty much everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to make one point, though, that you haven't brought up is about 42% of the people killed during this conflict were actually killed by the police. The police, contrary to international standards and even Kenyan law, used live bullets on demonstrators and looters. And so many of the people that were killed were actually killed by the police. And this is another one of those things that's going to have to be investigated, was the conduct of the police during this period.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's an important point to bring in, and I appreciate you doing that, because I think that perhaps also the kind of coverage that we've seen makes it look as if the kind of violence was supporters of the one or the other men,
right,
that were fighting with one another, and that didn't really seem to spend very much time in talking about what those people who were acting in an official capacity, in a sense, and representing the interests of the government, would have been doing.
That's correct.
Well, we're getting a caller here lined up to bring into the conversation. And again, for people who are listening, your calls are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. We have a caller here where we are in Champaign County. We'll talk with them on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. That was an interesting statistic. I hadn't heard it anywhere. There's some underpinnings of this struggle that seem that don't get visited very much in the regular press. It's kind of a drumbeat of mine, which is the idea that structural adjustment and the economic policies that are imposed upon Africa by the IMF, World Bank, et cetera, U.S. directly, kind of have a tendency to divide people. Payments for going to school, payments for health care in areas would favor, you know, the tribe that was more well-off, and it would exacerbate. I know it's not strictly a tribal problem, but you could see how these tensions would be exacerbated. And I think you're with the Friends, is that right? So you probably have a thoroughgoing critique of structural adjustment. And I think that often that kind of economic pressure, I mean, Kenya has always been pointed at as like sort of the test case, just like Argentina was following all the strictures of the IMF and the World Bank. Could you react to that?
Sure. The structural adjustment program was put on Kenya in the 1980s, and this meant, among other things, was that the government could not increase the number of people in the civil service, and this included the teachers. So the population was increasing substantially since the 1980s, but the number of teachers was not allowed to increase. And then in 2003, when Kibaki came to power, he gave universal free primary education, and another million students showed up. But with the structural adjustment, they were not allowed to hire any more teachers. So we got to the point where there were up to maybe 100 students in a class. And I've seen these classes, and, you know, maybe 30 or 40 in the front are sort of paying attention to the teacher, and the ones in the back are just, you know, playing or doing other things and obviously aren't learning anything. So this, in this new age, people have to be educated, and many of those people who were looters and rioters during the conflict were the people who missed their education because the structural adjustment program didn't allow them to have more teachers or adequate teaching staff and things of that sort.
Well, that's one on-the-ground aspect of it, but the whole concentration on export, I think flowers from Kenya go all the way to the markets in Amsterdam, and so a lot of that is also exacerbating, I would say, the tensions, and I think that's why, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just maybe you could talk a little bit about during the going back to your experience in the Peace Corps and coming up to the present during the time that you've lived and worked in Kenya. What are the most significant changes in the country that you have seen, or have you indeed seen significant change?
Well, I think the two biggest changes are cell phones and the internet. Back in the prior times when there was strife in the country, all you could hear was rumors. You didn't believe the radio stations and TV stations because you knew they were being monitored, and so you didn't really know what was going on. This time around, with cell phones, and I would call up people I knew in Nairobi or Mombasa or Kakamega, any town, and say, what's going on? And I could find out what their, at least in their neighborhood, what was happening. And then likewise with the internet, that information was easy to get out overseas. And also sometimes people overseas know more about what's going on than the people in the country themselves. And so information from outside would get back into the country. And I think this is why this became a international news story. While in the past, for example, 1992, people in my area say there was more fighting and conflict than there was this time around, but that time everything was clamped down. There were no reporters were allowed in the area, and there wasn't much news. So I think those two things are extremely significant in how Kenya has changed. The other big changes over the years, though, is that the population of Kenya, which used to have one of the highest population growth rates in the world, has grown substantially. I don't know, maybe it was about 15 million when I was there in the, say, 1970 or so, and it's now up to around 35 million. And the amount of arable land per person is only now 1.5 acres per person, and so land issues are becoming much more to the fore than previously.
Mm-hmm. And I expect that is the case there, as the case a lot of other people, that a substantial amount of your population growth is people who are, say, under 20?
I heard statistics that 71% of the population is under 30 years of age.
So, and there it's, and with kind of rising expectations that people have, that can be an important, probably important focus for either for unrest or for political organization or both. That is, if you have a lot of young people who have expectations about or hopes that they're going to have a certain standard of living, a certain kind of life.
Well, that's correct. And the election was a trigger in the sense that the youth felt the election was stolen from them, and that's why particularly the more politicized youth in the Nairobi and in Mombasa and Kisumu reacted so quickly and so negatively to the election results. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my case, the election results were not announced about 6 o'clock, and with about 10 minutes, I could see minibuses burning in the town that was about 2 miles away.
What sort of things was Mr. Odinga, the opposition leader, what was he proposing? What did his political agenda look like? And did indeed, was he proposing things that would be particularly dramatic or would have been a big departure from the kinds of things that the president would have been talking about?
Well, in this election, as in all elections in Kenya, both sides promised the moon. There's no way that either side could have fulfilled the promises that they were making. It was for prosperity, for lots of employment for the youth. It was redistribution of wealth in the country. It was improving the roads. It went on and on. Both candidates, I mean, just promised thing after thing after thing. Pre-secondary school education, both of them promised that. So the expectations actually were so unrealistically high that neither side actually could have come through with what they were promising. But a lot of the disillusionment with Kibaki was that he had promised many things back in 2002, and many of them did not come through with. And so many of the youth in particular were very alienated from his presidency because the promises he had made in 2002 had not been fulfilled.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and just very quickly, let me again introduce our guest, David Zaremka. He's coordinator of the African Great Lakes Initiative of the Friends Peace Teams. This is something that's been going on since the beginning of 1999, in involvement of the Quakers in Africa, a result of the realization that people had, American Quakers had, that there were significant numbers of Quakers living particularly in this part of Africa that we're talking about, that includes Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi. Particular concern that this was a place that there was a lot of violence and social unrest, and that it would be a good place for them to do the kind of work that they do, supporting grassroots peacemaking activities. So that's how it is that it came about. And again, as I mentioned, they do have a website if you're interested in finding out more about the African Great Lakes Initiative or the Friends Peace Teams. You can put those terms in your web browsers, or you can go to www.agli, so that's African Great Lakes Initiative, online.org, and you can find out about it there. Our guest, David Zaremka, has quite a bit of experience living in Kenya. He worked in the Peace Corps there and, in fact, was an election observer in the presidential voting that we were talking about here that took place at the end of December, last December, the 27th. Questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm just going back and wondering, you know, you were talking about the fact that now there will be commissions that are set up, truth commissions that are set up to look into the violence that followed the elections, and there's supposed to be a commission looking into the circumstances surrounding the what happened with the voting and then what happened to the ballots and to establish indeed was there electoral fraud. I guess I find myself wondering, though, what it would be likely to happen if indeed it was determined that the government was actually involved in promoting or carrying out violence when in this period after the elections.
Well, both sides have said that anybody who promoted violence would not get impunity and that they would bring to justice anybody on either side who promoted violence. Now, there's already been a number of accusations against various different people, and of course they always deny immediately that they had that they did what they were supposedly being accused of. So I think it's going to actually be quite difficult to actually pin anything on any particular one person. But on the other hand, the whole idea of impunity, that people can be violent and then nothing happens to them, perhaps will be discussed at great length, and hopefully there will be some kind of decision that this cannot continue in the future. The electioneering itself was quite violent. One assistant minister was found, for example, having what they call traditional weapons, that's machetes and bows and arrows and clubs, in his government vehicle, and he was called in by the police, but nothing happened to him. And another very senior minister was shown on TV about 2 minutes before a gang attacked one of the opposition politicians and put him in the hospital for 2 weeks, and nothing happened to him either. So this kind of thing can't be allowed to continue.
We have someone here calling who is on a cell phone, so we'll get to them on our line four. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I was very interested in your talk. I spent a few months working at the geothermal site in the Rift Valley in the 80s, and it was really terribly destructive here, the amount of violence that occurred there, since it seems like such a peaceful community when I was there. But the thing that really made me call is I was absolutely gobsmacked to hear that there were significant numbers of Quakers in the Great Lakes area of Africa. I was unaware of that. So I just wonder if you could maybe say a bit more on that. And actually, I'll take my answer offline if that's all right.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, actually, the biggest group of Quakers in the world is in Western Province of Kenya. There's at least 130,000 adult Quakers there. The Quakers went there in 1902 as missionaries, and sort of long before anybody else was there. And in those days, the Protestants divided up the country to different denominations, and they gave the Western Province to the Quakers. And And so Quakers, the missionaries, were very instrumental in starting schools and hospitals and giving education, things of that sort. And so there's a large group there. And then others have spread into Tanzania and Uganda. And then later, in the 1930s, other Quaker missionaries went to Burundi and then more recently into Rwanda. So in Burundi, maybe there's 15,000 Quakers, and in Rwanda, maybe there's 5,000.
Let's talk again with another caller here. This person is in Crete. That's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, about 50 years ago, there was an uprising against the British rule of Kenya, led by Kwame Kenyatta, and it was a group also called the Mau Mau. I just wondered what your guest knows about them today. Are they sort of like retired American Revolutionary War heroes, or how has the Mau Mau influenced on the new generation of Kenyans?
Well, actually, a lot of books are being written on that right now. There's one called Imperial Reckoning about the Mau Mau. And essentially what happened is Kenyatta was not on the Mau Mau side, although he was charged that way, but his son Peter Kenyatta was the leader of the loyalist side of during the Mau Mau Rebellion. And maybe 10% of the Kikuyu were on the loyalist side. And at the time of independence, the British gave the independence to the loyalists, not to the Mau Mau fighters, who were the ones that then had to sort of immigrate into the Rift Valley and to other parts of Kenya and become the small shopkeepers and the taxi cab drivers and things of that sort. So actually, that loyalist group is it turned itself into this ruling elite that we're talking about now, that has been controlling Kenya since the time of independence. It doesn't, you know, the conventional wisdom back in the old days was not written this way, but if you read these new books that have come out, which go in, have interviewed many of the people who were around at the time of Mau Mau, and analyze exactly what happened, who benefited and who didn't benefit, you can see that was the beginnings of the elite that now has been controlling Kenya ever since that time. So, and if I can make one other point about the Mau Mau, is that in Central Province was the Kikuyu Province. During the time of Mau Mau, the death rate, the number of percentage of people that died in that province was higher than the percentage of people who died in the Rwandan genocide. It was extremely brutal. Women and children were rounded up and put in concentration camps without sufficient food, without medical care, and the men were carted off to prison, and many of them were tortured, and it was a very, very brutal time. And I think that some of the police brutality and things of that sort have come down from that era of the Mau Mau.
So the Mau Mau don't have any special place in Kenya society, as if the American Revolutionary War heroes would be given honorary funerals, etc.
Well, there are a few that do have that. I mean, they've put up some statues to the leaders of the Mau Mau Rebellion and things of that sort. But those ones who were the Mau Mau fighters have been looking for pensions and, you know, land and all that kind of thing since the time of independence, and they have not really succeeded very well.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're coming to the point we have just a couple of minutes left, and as a way of summing up, I'm interested in going back to some of the points that we were talking about at the beginning of the program, where we were talking about the way that the post-election violence was covered by a lot of Western media. The difference between that, the story that we were getting there, and the more nuanced kind of story that you're giving us, that's the perspective of someone who actually was living in Kenya and was seeing what was going on. And I guess it makes me think about the differences between the story, the kind of stories that we get in Africa in Western mainstream media, and the difference between those stories and what things are really like. I guess that's the place that I would like to maybe end up and have you talk a little bit about what we say in the United States, a lot of what we read about Africa, and how that doesn't do a very good job of representing the reality.
Well, all the conflicts anywhere in the world, but particularly in Africa, are not simple. They're not just this tribe against that tribe or this group against that group. but they're very intricate and complicated, and there's various different layers and different actors. I mean, we would in the United States, we discuss all these things. But when it comes to Africa, it seems that it's so easy just to say it's this group against that group, and that sort of explains everything. You know, the French and the Germans did fight each other, but now they're big buddies in the EU. So that doesn't, you know, you have to delve deeper in to see why these whatever antagonisms have come to the surface in order to understand much better how things need to be fixed. If you see it only as an ethnic conflict, then, well, you really throw up your hands and say, oh, this is the way things have been, you know, since eons ago. But if you really want to fix the problems that are there, you have to analyze all the various different aspects of it, which is what I've been trying to convey here in this speech, this talk today, mm-hmm. In order to turn a country around and put it on a positive direction.
Well, there we'll have to leave it as we've come to the end of the time. Again, if you're interested in finding out more about the African Great Lakes Initiative of the Friends Peace Teams and you have internet access, put either of those phrases in your browser, and I'm sure that you can find them. Our guest, David Ceremka, is the coordinator of the Great Lakes Initiative. He served in the Peace Corps in Kenya, has been there, living there for some time, was an election observer in this election that took place on the 27th of December. Spending a little time here now in the United States. Mr. Ceremka, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up next time on the Afternoon Magazine, and that means today, Celeste Quinn will be talking about what's called food insecurity. To be food insecure means either occasionally or often that you don't know where your next meal will be coming from. Her guest today will be Mark Winnie. Since the 70s, he's worked to address the problem, and they'll be talking about what he's learned. He's the author of a book entitled Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host. Show gets underway at noon. Support for the program today comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Right now we're going to break for an update on the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products to farmers in East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service provides customer services and agronomic information to help customers maximize profits. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at midday, there is plenty of red on the screen. Let's go right to the prices. May wheat in Kansas City trading now at $11.53, down 60. July, $11.31, down 44 and a quarter. At the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat trading $10.98, down 66. July, $10.88, down 50. December, $11, down 54. May corn, at 527¾, down 19½. July, 540½, down 18¾. September, 543, down 18½. December, 541¼, down 20. May beans, 1257, down 50. July, 1272, down 50. August, 1266, down 50. November, 1190, down 50. May soybean meal, 316.30, down 40.